Today we're beginning here on the top of Simon Gimel Amud Aleph. The Gemara is speaking about the ingredients or the detergents that we spoke about in the Mishnah. One of those was Rok Tafel, and the Mishnah itself discussed what was the Rok Tafel, was who Rok Tafel, Koshalo Tam Klum, somebody who didn't taste anything, and now the Gemara is going to explicate on that. Tana, Koshalo Tam Klum Mi Ba'erev, somebody who didn't taste anything since the evening. Sabra Papa Kamed the Rabba, Rapapa wanted to suggest to Rabba the Maymar Kimanda Amar, Lotam Mide Baorta. Sounds like somebody who didn't eat anything since the night before. Amale Rabba Miktani Ba'erev. Doesn't say over here that someone who didn't eat anything Ba'erev in the evening. It says Mi Ba'erev Ktani. It says they didn't eat anything since the evening. Afuke Hecha Dekadim Ba'achil. Comes to exclude a case where he got up early in the morning and then ate before the morning broke. So now, based on that, we would have an assumption that you can eat the night before. That's not a problem. The only point is that once you've eaten the night before, and then you have gone to sleep, then you can't wake up and eat before you get this Rok Tafel. Otherwise, it'll mitigate the potency of the Rok Tafel. And as Rashi says over here, Lefisha Sheina Memareret et Rok, the sleep causes the saliva to become bitter or more potent. Umechazakato, and strengthens it. And the problem is, someone who eats, mamtakato, eating or food, makes it sweeter, mavirat kocho, and ruins its potency. So, the necessity over here is to have both sleep, which increases the potency of the saliva, and also not eat. But then, when do you have to start that from? Sounds like over here that you only have to start Mi ba'erev, not a case where you have to not eat the night before, but you can eat the night before, but once you've eaten the night before, you can no longer eat until you've woken up in the morning and you've used that or got that saliva that you need. Amar Rabbi Bachan, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Ezu Rok Tafel, Kosher Bar Lav Chatzot Halayla. That's if you went through midnight, Ubisheina, while you were asleep. Lememra de Bisheina Talia Milta. So it sounds like from here that it has to do with sleep. Batznan. Yeshan kol hayom, if he slept all day, ein ze rok tafel. That's not considered to be rok tafel. Neyor kol halayla, hari ze rok tafel. And if you're up all night, that is considered to be rok tafel. So it doesn't seem to be correlated with the sleep pattern, but has to do with, again, as we noted before, the lack of eating. And that is, during the day, the person, as Rashi says, went ahead and ate breakfast. And eating breakfast has long-ranging implications through the day. Someone eats a good breakfast, gets enough from that all day, and therefore once you've eaten breakfast, even if you sleep all day, it's not going to produce the type of saliva that you're looking for. And then on the opposite side of that, when you don't sleep at night, that's not the issue. The issue is that you don't eat. That after you ate dinner, then you don't eat all through the night. That's what creates this saliva, this Rok Tafel. And therefore it shouldn't matter whether you sleep at night or not. So now it's somewhat difficult because Rabbi Bar Chanan, Rabbi Yochanan says that Rok Tafel has to do with going through midnight with sleep. And here we say that sleep is irrelevant. So Gemara says, no problem. Hatam b'mitnamnein. Over there, when we said he was up all night, it doesn't mean he was literally up all night. It means that he was dozing off. Hechidami mitnamnein. What exactly does it mean that you're dozing off? Amravashi nim velo nim, tir velo tir. So the way that Rashi explains it in other places is he is falling asleep, but he isn't falling asleep. He's awake, but he's not really awake. So it's this in-between state of dozing off. Whereas the Baalei Tosafot say that this has to do with two different ends of your sleep. That before a person falls asleep, then they are nim velo nim. They are kind of falling asleep. They're not totally asleep. And then when they awaken, they're tir velo tir. They awaken, but they're not totally awake. So he says it's at the two tail ends of your sleep, one at the beginning, one at the end, and that's the description here. Dukari le va'ani. If you call him, if you call his name, he will respond. Below the adure svara. But if you ask him something complicated, you ask him to elaborate or give you some logical reason behind something, he won't be able to do that. Chimidgaru le midgar. But if you remind him, if you feed him the information, he'll be able to answer in the affirmative or the negative. So he can't come up with ideas or information on his own, but if you feed him the information, he can respond to that information. That's the type of dozing off that we're speaking about here. Tana hishkim v'shana pirko. Person got up early to go over his learning. Ein ze rok tafel. That's not considered to be rok tafel. It seems to be, as Rashi says here, hadibur mavir koach arok. That speaking takes away the potency of the saliva. So you want this, we call it virgin saliva, that doesn't have any speech that's been associated with it, because that already mixes it or reduces its potency. And same with eating. Eating is another factor that reduces the potency of it. So we don't want you eating, not since the evening before, not before you get up in the morning. We also don't want you speaking too much. Vad kama, how much is that? Amar Rabbi Yehuda bar Shila, Amar Rav Ashi, Amar Rabbi Elazar, Koshi Yatsa Rov Diburo, Shel Shalosh Shaot. If he normally speaks or goes over his learning for 3 hours, so then if you've gone through the rove already, that's a mitigating force. So eating is a much faster way to ruin the rove tafel. Speaking takes time before it has a real impact on the rove tafel, and it'd have to be that the majority of the 3 hour span that the person normally would speak or go over his learning, if he's already gone through the rove of that time period, that already has ruined the rove tafel. Now, as to exactly what the structure is over here is not clear, because the requirement of Rabbi Bar Chana Rabbi Yochanan was chatzot laila, you have to cross, ubesheina, and sleeping. So the question is, do you then need to sleep from before chatzot until after chatzot, which means you have to go to sleep early and then get up in the morning, and that's what rok tafel is, or do you just need to straddle the chatzot laila, which means you can either go to sleep early in the evening, wake up after chatzot, and that's sufficient. Or you can go to sleep right before chatzot, and then sleep until the morning. And then you would only require a shorter window, which crosses over chatzot, which is that you got to sleep before chatzot, and then slept through the morning, or you got to sleep early in the evening, and then crossed over chatzot. Or does it mean you need to sleep through the whole night, including chatzot? Obviously, in any of these cases, you shouldn't be eating after the dinner time period, but it's not clear here exactly how much sleep you need, and that turns out to be a machloket in the Rishonim. So the Rambam views this as being the requirement that you don't eat from the night before until the next morning, and the chatzot alayla here just tells you how long you need to sleep in order for this to be the case, and that's the 6 hours, mechatzot alayla until the morning. So you need 6 hours of sleep plus roughly 12 hours of fasting in order for this to be rok tafel. That's the view of the Rambam. The Baalei HaTosafot believe that even if you went to sleep right after dinner and woke up after chatzot, that would be sufficient because you slept and crossed over chatzot. So it doesn't matter if you had the 6 hours at the beginning of the night, 6 hours at the end of the night. As long as you didn't eat after dinner and slept for 6 hours, that's sufficient grounds to make it into rok tafel. All right. Megrisin, le'isat bisim shelpo. We saw again in the Mishnah the explanation of what these juices of the bean were, and that was the chewed up grits of the split beans that had naturally deshelled themselves. Lema misayle the Reish Lakish. Sounds like our Mishnah is supportive of Reish Lakish's contention. Damar Reish Lakish, rok tafel, tzrich sheim kol echad ve'echad. He says this rok tafel is added to all the other 6 ingredients. It's even as if it's like a super ingredient that's added to all the other ingredients or meshed with the other ingredients. Gemara says you don't have to say that. Dilma havla de puma mali. So maybe that's not the reason why you have to chew on the beans. It's not because you need to add rok tafel, you have to add saliva to them. But rather, the reason you need to chew on the beans is because the warmth of the mouth gives it whatever potency or increases the potency of the bean. And that's why you need to chew it in your mouth, not to get the saliva on it, but rather to get the hot air, the warm air that's coming out of his mouth. Therefore, you don't have a proof from our Mishnah to Reish Lakish, not a dismissal, but at least not a proof. But Tanitz in the Lok Rabbi Yehuda, our Mishnah is not like Rabbi Yehuda, the Tanya Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Megrisin. He explains what Megrisim are, Roteach, Volver, Shinitein, Letocho Melech. It is when you boil the beans up before you put the salt into the pot. So you're boiling them and then you would add salt to them. Before you add the salt to them, that's what we're speaking about here. My mashma dahai over lishnadak dumehu. How do you know that the word over means beforehand? The Gemara in other places, including the main sugya in Pesachim, discusses that all brachot have to be over le'asiatan. And the Gemara wants to know there, how do you know over le'asiatan means before you do the mitzvah, you need to make the bracha? And so the Gemara asks the same question here as it asked there, which is here, he used the term va'over she'tein l'tocho melach, before you put the salt into it. How do you know the word va'over means prior to or before? So that's the Gemara brings a number of psukim. Rav Nachum Yisuf Damakra, the posuk says in Shmuel Bet, by the merit of Shalom, v'yaratz achimatz derech hakikar, v'yavor et akushi. Yoav sends word to David HaMelech that Avshalom has been killed, the rebellion has been suppressed. He sends the Kushi to go inform David, and Achimatz is very excited and wants to be the bearer of the news, or the good news, to David HaMelech. And Yoav says to him, Lo yom b'sora hayom. This is not the type of news that David's going to want to hear, even though it was a suppression of the rebellion. Achimatz ignores him and runs ahead. And it says there, Vayavor et HaKushi, that he passed by the Kushi, but it's not that he passed by him, it means that he was now in front of him, and he got the news to David HaMelech before the messenger that Yoav had sent, who was the Kushi. Abaye Amar Meocha says from Yaakov Avinu when he's meeting Esav, says, V'hu avar lifnehem. It says there that Yaakov passes in front of his family. He moves to the front of his family. So again, the avar means that you pass by. But it's in the context of passing by to be in front or to be the leader. From the Pasuk in Micha, V'yavor Malkam Lifnehem, V'Hashem Berosham. Their king passed before them, meaning he's leading them, V'Hashem Berosham. And Hashem's even before that king. So he is the one taking them out to battle. He's the one that's leading their way in battle. So again, all of these cases, the word V'yavor means to pass before, but pass before in the context where the person after passing now becomes the front line or is before everyone that is there, is leading and is in front of them. And so it's over here, the word over means before that has happened. This is prior to Yitain L'Tocho Melach, or in the Gemara Pesachim, over le'asiyatan, before you've taken the action, then we want you to make the bracha. Right now, the Gemara says, with the last of the three ingredients that are explicated on in the Mishnah, Meira Glein Sheikh Mitzu, urine that has fermented. Tana Kamachi Mutzan, how long do they need to ferment? Shlosha Yamim, for 3 days. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Kol Shirei Chachamim B'Ktamim, Tzarech Shiur D'Shiuran. Any Shiur that was given by the Chachamim, by Ktamim, needs additional explication or additional Shiur to determine for us what we're supposed to use. So you see over here already in Rabbi Yochanan's words that what was clear to the Tanaim, or whatever these ingredients were in the time of the Tanaim, by the time you're in the Amoraim, it's starting to become a little less clear what exactly were these ingredients and how to go about it, till the point today where the halacha is that we don't use this anymore. We don't use these methodologies because we're uncertain as to what exactly these ingredients are, how to use them properly, and therefore we don't use this test of laundering the ketem to determine whether it's dam or tseva or to be maleh, all the outcomes that we saw the different Rishonim articulated with regards to laundering of a ketem, whether for Rashi in Sanhedrin that meant that it is absolutely certain then that it's dai and not a dam, or for the two shitot that we saw in the Balei Tosafot that also followed by many of the other Rishonim, as to whether then it becomes tuma blu'a and it's mivutal, or it becomes a sveik-sveika with bittul, and that's what eliminates the problem of the ketem. We don't use any of these because of exactly what you're seeing here. There are sveikot, dielet o dezakein. Should it be urine from a young child or from that of an older person? Rashi claims over here, an older person's urine is more potent. Deish o deisha, from a man or a woman. Rashi over here makes no comment. Seems like he doesn't know which one is more potent. Michusim o migulim. Covered or exposed, Rashi over here says the covered urine is more potent than the exposed urine. Bimota chama o bimota gshamim, in the summertime or in the wintertime. And here again, Rashi says that in the summertime, they are more potent. So the question of Rabbi Yochanan is, the shi'ur that you need and the 3 days that you need, are those driven by which? The more potent urine? And then if you had less potent urine, you'd need more of it, or it wouldn't work. Or has it been driven by the less potent urine? If you had the more potent urine, then you would need less of it, and you would need less time. That's the question at hand. The Balei HaTosafot disagree with Rashi with regards to Yeled Ozakein, where they say that it is more likely that the younger child's urine is more potent or would ferment more, as opposed to Rashi, who says it is the Zakein. And also, and similarly with the man and woman, He says that the man's urine is more potent than that of the woman's urine. And he says that because the first safek of Yeledo Zakein is written in Lashon Zachar. So that shows you that it's more likely that the man's urine would be the one that is more potent. And then it follows a pattern throughout here that the first of the two in each of the pairs is the one that is more potent. And then he's consistent in that way, according to the Baalei HaTosafot, whereas Rashi makes Zakein more potent, yet the other ones are the first of the two that are given him the option. Tzarek lekaskei shalosh pe'amim. The end of the Mishnah says, with each ingredient, you have to rub it together three times. The way that they laundered clothing, by rubbing the clothing together, you have to do each one of those three times. Boy Rabbi Yirmiya, this is a question we saw back in the Gemara in Menachot, with regards to Halacha and Hava. It also has ramifications, as we've discussed in Menachot, and back in the Gemara in Sukkah, with regards to Na'anuim of the Lulav, shaking the Lulav also, where there is that same requirement. The question is the following: Amtuye v'atuye chad, going out and in is considered to be one, or Dilma amtuye v'atuye tarte, was going out and then in considered to be two. So that's the same thing by the nanuim, when we want to shake it three times in any given direction. Does three times mean you go out and in three times, or does it mean you shake out, in, out, and that would be three times? You only need one direction. We're going to be considered three. My, what's the din? Teiko, we leave it as an unresolved issue, and therefore we generally are machmir, or we consider the possibility that in and out is considered to be one, and therefore, in this case, we would require you to rub it back and forth three times, and similarly with the nanuim, the way that we do nanuim, are to go out and in three separate times in each direction, and to shake at that same time the lulav, because of the others that believe nanuim are not necessarily the actual movement in and out, but actually the movement of the lulav itself. And in that way, we accomplish all the different possibilities here because of the teiku that is left in the Gemara. If you run shalok and sidran, if you do them out of order, or we said if you do them all at once, they don't work. Tanrabanan, ikdim shnaim shniim l'rishonim. If you did the second set before the first set, and tani chada, one of the brayot says, if you did such a thing, shniim alu lo rishonim lo alu lo, the second set works, the first set doesn't work. Tanidach, we have another brayot that says, rishonim alu lo, the first set works, shniim lo alu lo, the second set doesn't work. So the Gemara views the Mishnah the way that Rashi explains it over here. It's broken into two sets. There's the first three ingredients, which are a set to themselves, and that's because those three the Mishnah explicates upon afterwards. So that would be the Rok Tafel, Megri Sim, and Meiraglayim. That's the first set. And then you have a second set of four, which are the Neter, Borit, Kominia, and Ashlag. So you have two sets. The first set is the three, and then the second set is the four. What happens if you did the four of the second set first, and then went back and did the three of the first set? Now, based on the Mishnah, it says if you do it out of order, it is no good. The problem is that this Braita seems to indicate that in those scenarios, one point the second set is okay, and one point the first set is okay, which seems to be at odds with our Mishnah and at odds with itself. There's some sort of stira between these two brayot. So Amar Abaye, Abaye comes to resolve all of these problems by saying, idi v'idi, shniim alu, lo v'lo rishonim. That in all of these cases, it was the second set that counts, the first set does not count. So when you do the four ingredients that were supposed to be at the end, you did them first, then you go back and do the first three ingredients. The first four ingredients were worthless because they were out of order. The second three ingredients that you did, which are really what you were supposed to do up front, they can count as the first three if you do another four afterwards. So what you did is, if you went ahead and did the Neter, Borit, Komonia, and Ashlag, then after that you did the Rok Tafel, Megri Sim, and Meiraglayim, then that Rok Tafel, Megri Sim, and Meiraglayim could be the first three for the next, if you then continue and do the next four. So then after that, if you did Neter, Borit, Komonia, and Ashlag, it would work. So that's what Rebbe says. That's what's being said here in the Braitot. And that's how they are differentiated from our Mishnah. They're saying that the Shniim Alulo, the second set, work because they are really the first set. And the first four that you did are meaningless. So then, to explain the Braitot, he says, my Rishonim, Rishonim the Kisidram. When it says the first ones work, it doesn't mean the first of the groupings that you did. It means the ones that were supposed to be first, those ones work. Ushneim Havaratan. or the ones that you did second. So the braita that says the second one is good means literally the rope tafel, the meraglim and the megrisim, because they were second to what you did. And the braita that says the rishonim were good are same saying the same thing, that the rope tafel and the meraglim and the megrisim, those are the ones that were supposed to be first, and therefore they work. And the chiddush here is that even though you did them with the four ingredients before that, it doesn't ruin the test. Which is that you could have thought, and we mentioned this in the Mishnah, when it says, v'lo asav v'lo klom, when you do them out of order, not only is it that you didn't succeed at doing the test, you also didn't do anything detrimental to make it that the test won't work. So even though you did the second set of four ingredients first, and then you did the first three ingredients, you can go again now and do the other four ingredients, and it would work. And we don't say what you did before ruined it or ruined the possibility of doing such a test. Okay, next Mishnah. Kol isha sheyesh la veset dayashata. This is a Mishnah that we saw earlier in the Masechta. And the Gemara will ask right away, why do we need another Mishnah to tell us the same information? Which is any woman that has a fixed cycle, then dayashata. We don't assume that there's any tuma l'mafreya. We don't assume that she had a sighting prior to the time that she actually discovered the sighting, because she has a fixed cycle, and therefore she can expect to see the dam when she normally would expect it. Either orach bizmanoba or reach bizmanoba. We assume that it comes at that time, and no time before that, and possibly no time after that. There is an exact time period where we expect her to see, and therefore dayashata, we don't have to worry about retroactive tuma, or tuma being in a broader spectrum of time than the time she expects it. Ve'elein vestot. This is what a veset is. Mifaheket. Now, the word mifaheket, it's difficult to understand what it means here. Rashi interprets it as istralir bilaz, which is a old French word, but if you look in the Masor de Shas, he brings from the Rosh, v'hu adam shepushet everav, the person who does a big stretch. Out of exhaustion, out of being tired, they do a big stretch. The Balei HaTosafot, on the other hand, disagree and say ve'enu nira, and they say that gabi piyeg v'meit ba'alir. They bring a different word that means something along the lines of yawning, which is actually what the word piyeg means in modern Hebrew. It's to yawn. Now they're not so far apart. The stretching because of the exhaustion or the yawning, just a question of which physical manifestation you have of that exhaustion. But that might be what Mifaheket has. There is another possibility that Mifaheket means a hiccup. Umeateshet. So again, in the modern Hebrew, Umeateshet would mean to sneeze. But over here, the Balei HaTosafot bring Ishtraniyar. They bring some other explanation, which possibly could mean one of the other items that we mentioned by Mifaheket. That might be what Umeateshet is, but we'll leave it as sneezing. V'choseshet b'fi kreisa, that she has some sort of pains by the belly area, ubishipulei meha, lower down in the bowels, although the way Rashi describes it over here, it's in her uterus that she has the sensation, vishofat, or she is flowing with dam, ukamin tzmar morot, tochuzimota, that she's captured by the chills or by shivering, v'chein koyotzeben, and any similar thing like this, meaning any physical manifestation where the body has a particular response, most likely an involuntary response, that indicates or is a preliminary to the sighting of dam. So if the woman has three times that she has yawned and seen her cycle, then we will assume that she has some sort of correlation with yawning and seeing her cycle. What that means is actually a makloka bishonim as to whether that means every time she yawns she has to be worried, or does that mean that every time she yawns, in the time period where you would assume it'd be normal for her to see her cycle, there's some sort of interval that we would assume that she has in her cycle, that she only has to worry about yawns at that time. And you can see in Tosfo what I just said, it says, V'kulu hani vestot, airi, shemifaheket o meateshet sha'au shtayim be'eit shirigilali rot. That she starts to yawn or sneeze in the hour or two where she normally sees. So Tosfo says that it's not just any time she yawns and sneezes, now she has to worry about it. It has to be within a context of when you would expect it, and it also can't be just one time. It says that it's not enough that she sneezes once, or she hiccups once, or burps once. That's not enough. He says one time that she does it, that's not an indication. It has to be a series of hiccups, a series of sneezes or yawns that then precipitate it, because otherwise it could be autocorrelation random correlation and not something that's indicative. And therefore, you need to establish that there's really a pattern here. And that pattern is established by multiple involuntary responses of the body. And that could be different types of responses, meaning that if you have, for a woman who yawns, hiccups, and then burps, and then has a sighting, that could establish a cycle based on that pattern that she has. If she does that every time, that might be enough. There also could be established a cycle if she yawns a number of times and then has a sighting for a cycle during the time period when we would have expected it. That's what those one says establishes the cycle. There are other Shonim who say that maybe the physical manifestation, maybe one time is enough, or that maybe even every time you have that physical manifestation, now you have to worry about it. But that's the way that you can establish a cycle, is by the association of some sort of involuntary response of the body that then precipitates the menstrual cycle that can establish a veset. Again, in the Tanaic wording, pa'am is associated with Lashon Zachar. In modern Hebrew, pa'am is Lashon Nekeva. So in modern Hebrew, it would be shalosh pa'amim. But the Mishnah, because it looks at it as Lashon Zachar, says kabbalah shlosha pa'amim or zeh veset. Anytime you've established a pattern of three times of this activity taking place, then we will assume that it is considered to be a veset for that. Tanina chada zimna, as we already noted, the Gemara said, the Mishnah already told us this way back in the beginning of Masechta, koisha sheish la veset dayashata. So why are you telling me that same information over here? It says, hatam vesto diyome. Over there it was talking about cycles based on days or intervals. Hacha vesto digufa. Over here it's talking about cycles with involuntary responses of the body that are indicative of the cycle. So the vesto at the beginning of the Masechta, which you already discussed, are, she sees always on the 15th of the month. She sees in a 30-day interval. Those are the vestot that were in that first Mishnah. The vestot that are being mentioned here are a different type of veset, where it's not based on a fixed interval or exact day of the month, but it's based on some sort of physical manifestation that precedes the sighting of the cycle. Kiditani, like our Mishnah says, Eluhein vestot, Haita mifaheket me'ateshet v'choseshet v'fi krisa v'shubulei me'ah v'shufat. So all of those are examples of physical manifestations that would then precipitate or be preliminary to the sighting of the cycle. So Gemara says, Shofat, how could Shofat be a siman? Ha, Shofa v'azwa. She's seeing dam flowing. How could dam be flowing be a indication that the nida is coming? If she's already flowing with dam, she's already a nida before she has any indications. Amarula braid the Rabbi Eli, Shofat, be dam tameh, mitok dam tahor. She has a cycle by which every time she has a sighting of Nida, it's preceded by a flow of Dam that is Tahor. She's seeing Dam that is in a color that doesn't make her Tmeah or is not considered to be Dam Nida. And others indicate that it doesn't necessarily have to be Dam. It could be that some women have like a mucus discharge, or they have some sort of liquid discharge that comes out before they become a Nida that's not even Dam. That could be the type of shofat that we're speaking about here, that there's something flowing that is always introductory to her then having a sighting of dam nida. And so there again, that's another physical manifestation that is indicative of the fact that the dam nida is going to follow. And that could establish a cycle by which that could be considered a veset kavua. Ukamin tzmar morot v'chulei. V'chein k'yotzeben. At the end of the Mishnah, it says, anything similar to this. The Gemara always asks the question when the Mishnah says something like that, Latuye Mai. What is not included in the list of the Mishnah that you'd want to add? Amar Rabbi Ba'ula, Latuye Isha, Shirosha, Kaved Aleha, Ve'evareha, Kavedim Aleha, Ve'rotachat, Ve'gosa. So this comes to include women that have, again, physical manifestations here, which are more along the lines of feeling sensations, rather than something where you have actually a physical manifestation. She has a headache. She gets a big headache beforehand. Now, the question of whether it has to be big or not is a good question. Is it enough that she just gets a headache? Or does it mean it has to be something serious, like a serious type of headache, which is indicative of it? Or a barak veidimala, where she feels heaviness in her body. She feels a sluggishness in her body. Rotachat, she feels very hot or feverish. Then the word also vigosa, which, again, over here, it's not clear what the meaning of the word gosa is. The Rishonim have many different explanations. Rashi over here says blyer, which the Tosfot HaRosh from the previous Amud said that that is yawning. So that would mean that Rashi thinks again that P.H. is stretching when you are tired from exhaustion, pulling your arms out to the side and stretching, whereas this ghost over here is yawning. The Bali and Tosafot already explained that the P.H. in the Mishnah was yawning. They have to explain ghost here as being something else. And therefore, they explain it as being something more akin to hiccups. And then there are those that explain Gosa, and the Oroch says this about Pihek in the Mishnah, that it's Kola Yotze Min HaGaron Mitoch Machal Kaved. It is a burp, something that comes up, a noise that comes up from the throat because of the heaviness of the eating or because you ate too fast, and therefore there's a burp. He says it about Pihek. Others say it about the Gosa that we have over here. And then still others say Gosa is a woman who throws up or has some sort of nausea that is associated with it. So again, all of these are possible physical indications that there's an onset of a Nida cycle. And therefore, if on a regular basis, the woman is aware of the fact that she has these sensations and right after she has these sensations, then she has a sighting of Dam, they can establish a fixed cycle with regards to this woman. Now, this is somewhat differentiated from what we said above, because earlier in the Masechta, we said that a woman who is pregnant is Mesuleket Damim, and we said the reason is because Rosho Kaved Aleha Ve'ed Vareha Kavedim Aleha, all of those were physical manifestations that were indicative of a pregnancy that then led to Siluk Damim. And over here, we're using them as a way to be a preliminary or an indicator of Dam that is flowing. So obviously, you have to differentiate between them. And you have to say that those that are associated with the pregnancy are much more significant and continuous. And that's why they're indicative of Siluk Damim. Whereas those that we're speaking about here are either shorter in duration or lighter in form. And that's why they are preliminaries to the sighting of their menstrual cycle and not an indication of Siluk Damim. Amar Rav Huna bar Chiya Amar Shmuel. Hari Amru liyamim shnayim levestot. Achat, lama shalomanu chachamim shlosha. That when it comes to establishing a cycle by days, meaning that if you always see on the 15th of the month, there you need shnayim. You only have to do it twice, and that's enough to be an indicative of the fact that you have a fixed cycle. Levestot, that which is mentioned in our Mishnah, meaning that the physical manifestations that you see in the Mishnah, achat, if it happens once, that's enough to correlate the physical activity with the menstruation. That which the Chachamim didn't mention explicitly, shlosha, you need three times. And now the Gemara asks, when Shmuel said this, he didn't indicate what it is that the Chachamim didn't mention that it's three times, and Shmuel, according to Rashi, Shmuel himself might not even know what it was. He just mentioned it, but he had no idea what it was. So now the Gemara asks, what are these items that the Chachamim didn't mention? And Rav Yosef le'tuye rosha kaved aleha, ve'barim kavedim aleha, v'rotachat v'gosa. The same answer that Rabbi Barula gave about the information that's missing from our Mishnah, the Kain Kol Yosef and by our Mishnah, Rav Yosef suggests that's what Shmuel was speaking about. Amar le'vaye ma'kamashpalan. Then what is Shmuel teaching us in that case? Matzniten he. That's our Mishnah. Da pirsha Rabbi Barula. Because Rabbi Barula already explained that that's already enumerated in our Mishnah. So that's not something that's not enumerated by the Chachamim, because that's included in Kol Yotze Ben. Elam Rabbi Letuye, it comes to include a case of Achla Shum Virata. Whenever she eats garlic, she has a sighting. Bachla Bitzalim, she eats onions, Virata, and then she has a sighting. Kisasa Pilpalim, she chewed on peppers, Virata, and then she has a sighting. So here you have all these physical manifestations that come through eating of a particular food that then generates this menstrual cycle that comes afterwards. Tosafot is bothered by these examples that are brought here by Abaye to suggest that these can be vestot, because the Gemara earlier in the Masechta said that with regards to kapsa, if a woman is jumping, that does not establish a cycle. And that's because all the examples that we had in our Mishnah are involuntary responses. They are not heavy activities that are generated by the person themselves. So kafsa is a problem because, first of all, it's a heavy activity. And number two is, it's determined by the woman herself. Only if she does jump will it happen. That's not something that establishes a cycle. We know women have cycles. So yes, if she jumped and then she sees her cycle, you might have thought that there's some correlation there for that makes it that every time she jumps, she has her cycle. But jumping itself can't be the precipitating force, because what happens if she doesn't jump? She's not going to see her cycle. That doesn't make any sense because it's a voluntary action. So Tosfot says, isn't that exactly what's going on here in the Gemara? You're eating and it's precipitating a menstrual cycle. So why should this work over here? So Tosfot says that only heavy activities that would be considered ones, would be considered something that it creates an involuntary response. When you jump very heavily, then your body might release because of that jumping or that physical activity. So when you do something like that, that's a causation that is done because of the force or the strenuous activity that you engaged in. Eating, which is a regular activity, if that precipitates a menstrual cycle, that's not considered to be something whereby the voluntary action is all of a sudden something that the onus creates or forces the dam to be released. And that's how Tosfot differentiates between that which we saw earlier in the Masechta about Katsa, which would not be a means by which to establish the cycle because it's onus, it's something that happens because of the strenuous activity, versus Achila, which is not considered to be onus because it's not like the Torah of Pitza, it is a regular mundane activity, and therefore if you engage in such a thing and you always have your cycle, then it makes sense because the person's always going to eat. And therefore, it could be something that precipitates the cycle. And it seems here, it's associated with particular foods. And again, we'll add in the Bali Tosfot from before. It probably has to be at this some time period where you would have expected the cycle to appear. Amar Rav Yosef Lushmiele, Haishmatata. Never heard of this before. I didn't hear what Shmuel said. All this information, everything that's being added here. Amar Abaye, Atamrita Nialan. You're the one who told us about it. Baha Amrita Nialan. And you said it about this memra, or this misora. Haita lumuda liot ro'a yom chamisha sar. If she regularly saw on the 15th of the month, v'shinta liyom esrim. And then she changes to the 20th of the month, ze v'ze asrim. Then both of them are now you have to worry about. In the next month, you have to worry about the 15th, which was the old cycle, and now the 20th, which is the possibly new cycle. Shalosh pi'amim liyom esrim. If she changes over and for three cycles in a row, she sees on the 20th of the month, Hutar Yom Chamishasar, V'Kabbalah Yom Esrin. Then the 15th is no longer in the worrisome column, and we don't worry about, or we don't consider the possibility she'll see on the 15th. Now we only consider that she will see on the 20th, and that becomes a new Veset. Sheini Shakovat La Veset, Achitikvena Shalosh Piamim. A woman cannot establish a cycle until she has three times. You need a Chazakah in order for that to happen. V'amartna Nala, and you told us on that Braita, Amar Rav Yehuda Mar Shmuel, Zo Divrei Rabbi Gamliel Barabi. That is all premised on the position of Rabbi Gamliel Barabi, Shamar Mishum Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, who has this in a Mesorah from Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Aval Chachamim Omrim, the Chachamim disagree, and say, Ra'ata, in a Tzricha lo lishnot, velo lishalish. If she's having sightings, she doesn't have to do it twice, or not three times. Ramina Lacha lishnot, Amar Tlan lishalosh mibayit. She doesn't have to see it twice, then why does she need to see it three times? V'amar lan, and then you explain to us, this is what we saw before in Shmuel, l'shnot v'vestot, l'shalosh v'yamim. And when it comes to establishing a cycle by vestot, you don't need to go to two times, because it's enough with one. That's what Shmuel had said, the vestot achat. And the shalosh v'yamim, you don't need to go to three for days, because two is enough. V'neima zo divrei Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Why doesn't he just give the attribution straight to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel? Why does he tell us that Rabbi Gamliel Barabi is saying this in the name of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel? Hakamashman Shmuel, so Shmuel was adding this additional information, that Rabbi Gamliel Barabi, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Svirle, that Rabbi Gamliel, the son of Rabbi, says this over in the name of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, or holds like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Why that is significant is because we have a machloket all over Shas between Rabbi Shimon Gamliel and Rabbi. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel believes in order to establish a chazakah, you need three times. Rabbi believes that you only need two times to establish a chazakah. So why it's interesting that Rabbi Gamliel Barabi holds like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is because he doesn't hold like his father. When you say that Rabbi Gamliel, the son of Rabbi, says like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, that means he says like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel and not like his father, Rabbi. And that's why it's significant to bring it down in his name, in the name of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. But what you see from here is that the requirement for three is based on a chazakah. It's based on that position of Shim Gamliel, which you can only establish a chazakah through three times. According to Rabbi, where you could establish a chazakah through two times would be sufficient, at least with regards to days, in order to establish a vested for days. Whereas physical vestot can be established even after one time. The reason that Rav Yosef did not remember this is because, as we know, Rav Yosef fell ill in the middle of his life, serious illness, where he lost his eyesight, as well as forgot all of his learning. And his Talmid Abaye afterwards learns with him and tries to remind him of things that he had said prior to the falling ill and helping him to reclaim his learning even after he had fallen ill. So that's why over here you see Abaye's Talmid reminding him that you did tell us this and giving him the context in which he had said such a memory over in the name of Shmuel. Hayta lemuda liot ro'a b'tchilat avestot. At the time when we expect her to see, she at the beginning of that period of time where she normally sees, she sees towards the beginning of it. Kol tarot she'asta b'tocha veset meot. Then anything that she worked with, any tarot that she worked with during that veset, then they are tmeot. So the assumption being over here that the veset is a period of time or a span of time, and therefore that span of time is a problem for this woman. And during that span of time, if she normally sees this at the beginning of that span of time, then anything she worked with during that span of time will be considered to be tmeot. The sova vestot, if she sees it towards the end of that period of time, then kol tarot she'asta b'tocha vestot tohorot. Then anything that's during that period of time will be tohorot. Meaning that you have a window of time. That window of time she normally sees at the beginning of that window of time, then we assume that anything she did during that window of time is problematic because we assume it came at its fixed time. If she normally sees at the end of that window of time, then anything done during that window of time is considered to be tahor. Rabbi Yossi Omer, af yamim v'sha'ot vestot. Here he says something cryptic, which the Gemara will explain. He says that even days and hours can establish cycles. She normally sees at sunrise. That's when she normally gets her menstrual cycle. In Asura, eliminates Achama. That's what Rabbi Yossi says now, that if she normally sights at sunrise, then when she becomes Asura is at sunrise. Yudomer, kol hayom shela. The entire day belongs to her. And again, we'll have to understand what that means, but as Rashi explains over here, muteret l'shamesh mishavar netzachama, velo ra'ata. If she passes through sunrise and doesn't have a sighting, then the remainder of the day is hers. But the implications of that are the night before were problematic for her. So the way that Rabbi Yehuda learns, and that's differentiated from Rabbi Yossi, and we'll see this in the Gemara in a second, is that Rabbi Yossi believes that a veset is a very, very fixed point in time, and the woman is not a surah before that fixed point in time, and not after that point in time. Just at that point in time is where she has a surah. If she sees then, obviously she's problematic afterwards because she had a sighting. But if she doesn't have a sighting at that fixed moment, then afterwards she goes back to being muteret. Rabbi Yehuda is more worried about the period of time surrounding or leading into that veset, and that depends on when the sighting is. Now, sometimes that can turn out to be before when she normally sights, sometimes it can be after she normally sights. And that we saw earlier in the Mishnah, sometimes she sees at the beginning of a period of time, sometimes she's at the end of the period of time, and all that become more clear in the Gemara. Okay, but over here, by Netzachama, since she normally saw at the end of the night, meaning at the sunrise, then we will be oser the whole onah, the whole period of time that surrounds that veset, which is usually a 12-hour period. So if she sees towards the end of the night, right by Netzachama, then the entire night should be asura until she clears that Netzachama. When she clears Netzachama, then she'd be muteret. Tana, ketzad amar Rabbi Yossi yamim b'shaot vestot. What exactly is meant by that statement of Rabbi Yossi that days and hours can establish a veset? Haitali muda liot ro'a miyom esrim liyom esrim. She saw every 20th of the month. That is her normal cycle. Umishesh sha'ot l'shesh sha'ot. Not only does she see on the 20th day, but she sees in the 6th hour. Then higia yom esrim, if the 20th day then comes around, v'lo ra'ata, and she doesn't have a sighting, asura l'shamesh kol shesh sha'ot rishonot. She's not allowed to be together with her husband for the first 6 hours of that day. Divrei Rabbi Yehuda. That's the view of Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yossi Matir Ad Sheishot. He says she's totally muteret until you reach the 6th hour. And then she has to worry about that sixth hour. If she passes through those 6 hours, then she remains asura for the remainder of the day, according to Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yossi Matir, min mincha lamalo, from mincha time and onwards, you are muteret. This is what I noted before. According to Rabbi Yehuda, it's not about before and after. It has to do with the ona. Ona is a period of time of 12 hours, either 12 hours of night, 12 hours of day. So here, this woman normally sees on the 20th of the month or every 20 days, and then 6 hours into the day, that's when her normal sighting is. For Rabbi Yehuda, that means that your ona is the daytime on the 20th. Daytime means a 12-hour period during the day. And that means even though she normally sees at the sixth hour, which is the middle of the day, she'll be asura from the beginning of the day till that point, and from that point till the end of the day, because that's the ona, the period of time when she normally has a sighting, she's asura lebala for that entire window of time. So you could have put Rabbi Yehuda together and just said she's asura the whole day, but because of Rabbi Yossi, they split Rabbi Yehuda up into beforehand and afterwards. But it means is that entire day, she is asura. Rabbi Yossi says, if it's in the sixth hour, we can pinpoint that veset, and you don't have to worry about the ona. If she has such a pinpointed veset where she sees on the 20th day in the sixth hour, all you need to worry about is the sixth hour. That means for the first 5 hours of the day, she is muteret de ba'ala. That means till 11 o'clock on that day, she is muteret. From 11 to 12 on that day, she will be asura. And then when mincha time comes from the seventh hour, which means from 12 o'clock and onward, she would be muteret. Now the problem with that is mina mincha namala, the Gemara in Pesachim tells us that that is starts at 12:30, does not start at noon. Yet over here, Rabbi Yossi is saying that mina mincha namala means from noon and onwards. The Baya Tosafot already raised this issue. It happens to be a stira in Rashi in the Gemara in Pesachim. In one place he gives one reason, in another place he gives another reason, which is michi yantu tzalalei erev. Once the shadow starts to cast towards the western side, that's when the mincha begins. And so the Gemara there says that's from 12:30 and onward. Mincha gedola starts from 12:30 onwards because that's the earliest time they ever brought the tamid shel ben arba'im or started the process of the tamid shel ben arba'im. It was on erev Pesach that fell out on erev Shabbat where they needed a lot of time to get it done before Shabbat. Then they would start earlier in Gemara and Tamid Shenishkat speaks about this in Gemara Pesachim. They started from 12:30. So why is it they start from 12:30 and not noon? So Rashi there gives two reasons, and Tosafot brings one of those two reasons. One was because the walls of the Beit HaMikdash were very thick, and therefore they only started to cast a shadow once the sun moved past the 12:30 point, not when it was dead center and moved off the dead center of the day. So that's one reason. The other reason is because people might make a mistake. They won't be so exact about it. It's not clear when the sun is in the center versus when it really moves over. So once you reach 12:30, it's clear that it's shifted and then the shadows will be cast in the opposite direction at that point in time. Nafka mina between those two explanations is it really at 12 o'clock? It's just that we can't tell and therefore we wait till 12:30 to be sure. If that's the case, then 12 o'clock is really zman mincha. 12:30 is just the safety. Or is it that actually 12:30 is zman mincha because the walls of the Beit HaMikdash were the determining factor. They were thicker. And therefore, the shadow only casts once you hit 12:30, which means 12:30 is the time for mincha. So that's exactly the nafkamina. If it doesn't matter, then you can put in a sundial, and at 12 o'clock exactly, you could switch and you could have daven mincha if you knew for sure that that was already into the afternoon. And that's what Tosafot brings over here, the same thing, that technically you can start davening mincha from the beginning of the 7 hours, but we wait a chatzi shah, hayim mishum dolo kimlan shapir bishir shaot hayom. The reason that is true is because we don't know so well when it's noon versus noon 30. About minadin, I mean tchilat zayin. Minadin, you could daven mincha from noon. So that's a big kula, and it can be used in some cases if you really are in a bind and you need to daven mincha before 12:30, that this possibility can be a possible kula with the tzibur for other things, that one could daven mincha drop earlier because of the fact that it really is from noon, according to these Rishonim, and not from 12:30. Obviously, there's a slew of Rishonim and even another Rashi that seems to indicate that Meikar did it's from 12:30. But over here, Tosfot invokes that idea to explain why Rabbi Yossi says, Mutar min ha-mincha l'mala. Tosfot Arosh disagrees with the Balei Tosfot and says that the midday really stretches from the point of 11:30 till 12:30, And that's how he deals with it. He brings the Tosafot's answer, and he says, Inami chatzi shvit v'chatzi shishit. Maybe it means from 11:30 to 12:30. That's the period of time that we're speaking about. And then Minha Mincha Mala would be literally from 12:30 and onwards, because that's the time that she normally saw her vesed at Chatzot Hayom, in the middle of the day, not Shei Sha'ot, meaning the sixth hour of the day, but the midday. And midday would stretch from a half an hour before to a half an hour after, and that's the hour in which she would worry about it. Aizah Limuda, she regularly saw it a period of time. Vatanya, Rabbi Yehuda Meir, Kol HaLayla Shelah. We have a bright that says the whole night belongs to her, whereas in the Mishnah it says the whole day belongs to her. So which one is it? Which ona is a surah, and which one is muteret? Lokasha. If she normally saw it during the beginning of the day, and the other one is when she saw at the end of the night. The sunrise is at that pivot point between night and day. So if you see she sees around the sunrise, if she normally sees right before sunrise, then her ona is the whole night. Then according to her Yehuda, the whole night she'd be asura. During the day she would be muteret. If the sunrise means right after sunrise, then according to Rabbi Yehuda, she should be muteret all night, and should be asura during the day. Because whichever point in time, the day or the night that you normally have the sighting, those 12 hours are the ona in which a husband needs to separate away from his wife because of the possibility of having a sighting. So that's the way that we can reconcile between the Braita and the Mishnah. Tani chada Rabbi Yehuda osra lifnei vesta, umatira lachar vesta. And again, we have two brightot that give seemingly differences in opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. One says that she's a surah before the veset and muteret after the veset. But Tanidach, the opposite. O surah lachar vesta. She's a surah after the veset. O matira lifnei vesta. As muteret beforehand. And again, velo kasha, that's not a problem. That's when she normally sees at the end of the night. When she sees at the end of the night, then before her veset, she's a surah. After her veset, she's muteret. Or, in a case where she normally sees the beginning of the day, then all night beforehand she's muteret. Afterwards she's a surah, because her vesed then is during the day. Amarova, aloha ki Rabbi Yehuda. The aloha is like Rabbi Yehuda, not like Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi pinpoints the time and says your vesed is a very particular time before and after, you don't have to separate. Because Rabbi Yehuda believes that you have to separate in the ona where the vesed falls out. Doesn't matter where the vesed falls out in that ona, but that whole ona, no matter whether it skews to more before or more afterwards, whether it's the 12 hours of day or 12 hours of night, you need to separate away from the husband and from Taharot. And Rabba says, Halacha is like Rabbi Yehuda. Umi amar Rabba achi? Did Rabba really say this? Vatanya. Vizartem et b'nei Yisrael mit tumatam. You have to guide b'nei Yisrael to stay away from their tuma. And there it follows with the pasuk about nida. And so in that context, it has the pasuk of nida. And it says that, Vizartem et b'nei Yisrael mit tumatam. That you have to warn b'nei Yisrael to be careful from tuma. Mikan amar Rabbi Yirmiya, or the other gear says, Rabbi Yoshia, Azara li b'nei Yisrael, shifrushum nisitehem, samuch levestan. That's a warning to b'nei Yisrael that they should separate away from their wives close to their veset. Vikama, how much time? Amarova, ona, a period of an ona. Na, ona means 12 hours. So you have to separate away 12 hours. My love, ona achrite. Doesn't it sound like from Rava, not only in the ona, where she's going to cite it, but even in ona beforehand, she needs to separate. Lo, ota ona. That warning over here means you have to separate in the ona where the vessel is going to fall, meaning that's the exact same thing that Rabbi Yehuda said, and therefore now we've correlated the din that Rava brings here with the psak that it's like Rabbi Yehuda. But then the Gemara says, v'tarte lamali. Then why do you need two biskei aloha to tell me the same thing, that the basically the aloha is you have to separate away at the ona. The woman normally has her veset. Tzricha, we need both of them. Diash minan ha. If I only had the one where we said the aloha is like Rabbi Yehuda, hava minu hani mila le tarot. I would have thought that's only by tarot that she has to separate. Alabalalo. But for her husband, she doesn't need to separate away. Because the context in which Rabbi Yehuda is speaking about is tarot, like our Mishnah, which is speaking about the tarot being tmeot. Makes it sound like this is an issue for Tarot. It's not an issue to separate from her husband. So therefore, I bring Kamash Balan, I bring the Pasuk that's speaking about Arayot and it's speaking about Tuma, and speaking about engaging with her husband. There, we now have a source for the fact that the husband also needs to disengage. Had I only had the Pasuk that's saying about the husband disengaging, Havamina Samuch Levesta Ona Achrite. When you say near her Veset, doesn't mean in her veset. It means next to the veset or before the veset. If you wanted to say that she has to separate away in the veset, you would have said they should separate bivesta. When it says in the limud from the pasuk, it says b'samuch levesta, near her veset, makes it sound like one before her veset, you'd have to separate away. So Kamash Malan, that's not the case. That's why I brought Rob over here, speaking to Rabbi Yehuda, which says it's oto ana. That limud teaches us about exactly that ona. You only have to separate away in the ona that you expect the veset to come. Now, there are a number of things to discuss over here. One of which is, you have here a source from a pasuk, and we know that the Gemara earlier in the Masechta concluded that vestot are derabanan and not doraita. The Gemara had a question whether vestot is derabanan or doraita. We passed in that vestot are derabanan. How could it be that vestot are derabanan if you bring me a posuk that says that you have to separate away during your vestot? That makes it sound like it's a din doraita. So the Rishonim take different approaches to reconciling that, one of which is to say that it is an asmachta b'alma. It's not a real limud from the pasuk. It's just a limud that leans a din derabanan on a pasuk. So that's one way to deal with it. The other way to deal with it is to suggest that you're dealing with two different issues. One issue is, do we worry that the individual has seen, or are we worrying about the individual will see? It's similar to a concept that we have in the Gemara and other places, where the Gemara says that shema mate, we don't worry about whether a person has died. We don't assume that a person has died. But we do worry about the fact that shema yamut, that a person will die in the future. That is because every person will eventually die. So to be choshesh for the fact that shema yamut, that someone will die in the future, that's a reasonable assumption. Shema mate, which is that we're already assuming the person died, that's not necessarily something that's factual or you can establish. We don't worry about somebody sends a korban that they already died by the time the korban comes, and you shouldn't bring the chatat that they sent, because we don't worry about shema mate. But we do worry about in the future that somebody might die, shema yamut, and therefore we have to take precautions in different halachos because of that. Similarly over here, with regards to a nidah, we say that shema ra'ah, that she already saw min haTorah, we don't worry about that. We don't assume she definitely saw in her veset min haTorah. But shema yireh, maybe that she will see, that we do worry about. So the Torah tells you to separate away because she might see. But if you cross over that threshold and she didn't see, we're not going to worry about the fact that she did see and she missed it, or she's automatically tmeiah. That's only in the institution of midrabanan, that she becomes tmeiah at her veset if she didn't check, or if she didn't have a sighting, we still worry about it. So the requirement to separate away in anticipation of the veset is the doraita. That's the requirement that the husband separate away. Whereas the din derabanan is that we worry about the sighting, the beginning of the cycle, at the time of the veset. And that's the difference between we worrying about shema tireh versus shema ra'ah. So that's another way to separate between the doraita aspect and the derabanan aspect. The other possibility is that in the anticipation of the onah, the separating between the time of the onah, the beginning of the onah, till the veset itself, that is considered a din derabanan. Whereas from the veset itself until the end of the onah, that would be the din doraita. So the different ways to break this down between how we understand this pasuk and the din derabanan of vestot. The other thing to discuss over here is what we know as the chumrat haor zarua. The Or Zarua instituted or put into practice the idea that we are machmir not only to separate away in the onah where you expect the veset, but even in the onah preceding. Exactly what the Gemara said Rava didn't say. That's what the Or Zarua says we are choshesh for. We worry about the fact that if you just separate away in the onah itself, there are risks because you could see way at the beginning of our onah, and that's very risky. And there's a little bit of give because an onah stretches over a fixed period of time of 12 hours of day or 12 hours of night. A cycle may not be so exact that it falls in the middle of the day, the middle of the night. It might be at the edges and it might overlap. Therefore, the Or Zarua suggested that we keep an extra onah beforehand. And therefore, anytime you have a possibility of sighting for women with the veset kavua, that means at the time they normally expected that onah, when they expected she would be a surah the bala. And the onah beforehand, she would also be a surah the bala. For women that don't have a fixed veset, and then they have to be chosheshet for veset ayom, veset achodesh, and veset dilug, which are two or three different possibilities, then in each of those time periods where she could possibly see that onah should be a surah. and then the ona before. There should be some overlap between all of those, but we do take a precaution and separate away the ona beforehand according to the Or Zarua. The Chumrah is actually quoted by the Ravan, and then the Or Zarua himself quotes it. Umariya Bia Ezri, Amarli, Shirigimli Frosh, Samuch the Vesta Kaptala Shot, for the 24 hours close to the Veset, that the women normally separated away. And the Mahario brings it in the name of the Maris Segol, that when it says that a person has to separate away from his wife, Samuch the Vesta, that means a full 24 hours, not 12 hours. The Ogur commenting on this din of the Or Zarua says that it is a chumrah gidolahi. And the Beit Yosef, in quoting this, says about the psak halacha that we paskin based on the Gemara like Rabbi Yehuda, that you only have to separate away in the onah itself. And he says that what you find in the name of the Or Zarua, there is no basis for it in the Gemara. And the poskim, including the Agur, already say that it was a chumrah yitera that doesn't need to be kept. Although, if you look in the Bach, he says, that it's worthwhile to keep the Chumrah of the Or Zarua, because he obviously had a strong Mesorah for that, and he also tries to give explanation for why it is that the Or Zarua is based on what the Gemara says, based on the Havamina of the Gemara over here, which says, Samuch Levesta seems to have meant for 24 hours. And even though Rabbi Paskin's Aloha not like that, nevertheless, he says that it makes sense, and it makes sense because of what we noted, that sometimes the vesset happens right at those pivotal moments, and therefore there is reason to worry for it. Meshach comes to a compromise position, which is a woman has a fixed vesset to normally see not only at a particular day or night, but at a fixed time, then she doesn't have to worry about the Or Zarua, whereas a woman who has a vesset to see during the day or during the night in a wide range of time periods during that onah, then they should be choshesh for the chumrat Or Zarua and separate away even the onah beforehand. And many of the poskim in the tshuvot, like the Chatam Sofer and the An Yosef, they've discussed the possibility that there is room to be mekil in extenuating circumstances during the onah of the Or Zarua, because it is not midina de gemara, but rather a chumrah ba'alma. So there is room to be mekil, although the Shevet HaLevi, when he's discussing about the Onah Benunit, which is a fixed 30-day interval that we're choshesh for a woman who doesn't have a veset, which is already a somewhat of a chumrah, there were those that wanted to suggest that on top of that, you didn't need the chumrah Or Zarua, whereas the Shevet HaLevi says he thinks you need to keep the chumrah Or Zarua even in that instance. So in general, the practice when it is not too much of a burden or extenuating circumstances is to keep this Onah Or Zarua, whereas when it's a woman who has a very, very fixed cycle, or it's a situation in extenuating circumstances where, for whatever reason, they need more time, then you can ask a Rav, and there is room to be making with regards to the Onot Or Zarua. But for sure, in terms of Harchokot, there's no reason to keep the Harchokot, and maybe even for Chibuk and Nishuk, during that Chumrah of the Onot of the Or Zarua. That period of separation is not a full separation of the husband and wife. It is a separation away from at least Biyah, maybe chibuk v'nishuk, but not the harchakot of nida. It's only a chashash. It's not that she is established for certain that she is a nida. Okay, the next mishnah, we'll stop with that. Haitali muda liot ro'ah yom tedbav. This is what we quoted up in the Gemara before. If she normally saw on the 15th of the month, v'shintal liot ro'ah liyom kap. Now she starts seeing on the 20th of the month, zeh v'zeh asurim. The next month, she has to worry about the 15th, which was her old cycle, and the 20th, which was this new sighting. Shinta pa'amayim, she switched twice, the Yom Chav, Zeh v'zeh asurim, it still remains that the 15th, which was a vesset that was established by a chazaka, still has to worry about, and the 20th she has to worry about, because she hasn't established a chazaka yet, but she saw it previously on the 20th. Shinta gimu pa'amayim, the Yom Chav, she already switched three times to now the 20th, Hutar tetvav, the Kavala Yom Chav, she now switched her cycle. The chazaka by the 15th has been broken, because she now sees three times in a row on the 20th. Now she's established a new cycle that will be three times on the 20th. Jani Shakovata Veset, Ashikavena Gimo Pami, because you can't establish a cycle until you had a sighting three times, which is what we saw in the Gemara, was the view of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, who says the Chazaka requires three times, and Rabbi Gamliel Berabi agrees with that position of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, even though his father Rabbi believed you only need two times to establish a Chazaka. And again, this all has to do with establishing a Chazaka for Yamim, on a particular day. And you're not released from a veset that was established until you undermine it three times. So until you undermine it three times, that veset will stay in place as well. And that's why we discussed with regards with a woman who's pregnant, really has to wait three times to establish that she is Mesulekat Damim, because in the first three times, she's still working with the chazaka that she had beforehand that she normally would cite dam. So only after she's passed three cycles will we then say that she is Mesulekat Damim, because she's broken the previous chazaka. And also, in their day, it was usually around the time period where they knew that she was pregnant. And we discussed earlier in the Masechta as to whether today, where we know or have information about the pregnancy earlier, does that change the din of having to worry about those vestot or not? Generally, the practice is to worry about those vestot, even when we know for certain the woman is pregnant because of the chazaka that was established. Okay, we're going to stop here at the bottom of Samach Gimel Amud Bet.